Well, this is an opportunity to regroup a bit. So we've, of course, talked about now the two giants, Plato, Aristotle. And if there was an impasse between Heraclitus and Parmenides, it was even worse, more profound with respect to these two, because they were obviously transcendently more geniuses. And each of them had a huge impact. And as the man on the street begins to try to figure out which way am I going to go, you know, it just seems impossible. How do you choose between a Plato and an Aristotle? And so you have philosophy generally devolving into this period of malaise that we were looking at last week in connection with the Stoics or the Epicureans, a variety of mystery religions, Philo, and a ton of others, all of which were kind of floundering, you know, just wrestling with lesser issues and trying to win a little following here and there, but nobody really stepping up and saying, let's resolve this big, huge philosophical conflict that's hanging out there. Well, the Christian faith didn't come along consciously to solve that problem. That wasn't, you know, the reason Jesus was born, was to figure out how to resolve Plato with Aristotle. It just so happens, however, that in some ways that is what happened. And then the Christian faith philosophically conditions everything else. From now on, every philosopher we study, whether Christian or not, has to be understood against the backdrop of the Christian faith, because that's what they're all dealing with. A Nietzsche, who's a great atheist, is still in conflict with the Christian faith and calls himself the crucified one when he dies. You know, none of these people can escape it. From now on, this is the only game in town. And so whether you're against Christ or for him, you got to deal with him. And so we find that, you know, for some reason or other, the Christian faith had an effect on philosophical thought in a way that, you know, you'd never say Buddhism did or Hinduism did or even Islam did. It's the Christian faith that really kind of established this benchmark. So let's think about it for a minute. We have Plato, my much more detailed outline now. Hope you appreciate. I use quite a bit more ink this week. But let's think now in broad terms about Plato, first of all. And we've talked about his ontology, we've talked about his epistemology. So if you had to tell me in one word or one phrase where you would go or what you would refer to with respect to the ontology of Plato, what would it be? Anybody? Where would you go? What would you refer to for Plato's ontology? Mr. Kim? The ideal world, certainly. And does he believe the ideal world is real? Yes, that's why he is a realist and at the same time an idealist. The ideals are real. They are not fig Newtons in your imagination. They're not just simply idle imaginations, ideas we've dreamed up, which is what the nominalists would eventually say, but they are actually out there. They are the fundamental reality of our existence. How does he say that we can know that ideal world? What's his answer to that? This is all review, so it's right on the top of your head, tip of your tongue.
We remember it.
Theory of recollection. Now, you'd have to say, in terms of Plato's view, his ontology is strong. He has a robust, powerful, deep conviction that there is at the heart of reality this that is real, which gives us true understandings of what's good, what's true, what's beautiful. He believes all of that is parked right deeply in something that we can really trust. But then you say, okay, well, Plato, how do we know it's there really? I mean, I appreciate that you're saying it's there, and if it is there, that's great. That gives me a lot of confidence. But how do I know for sure? And he says, well, you kind of remember it, you know? And I said, boy, is that the best you can do? I mean, can't we actually go somewhere and see it? Can't I put it in a test tube? Can't I somehow experience it? Well, no, actually, you just have to kind of recall it. You have to have a sort of intuition of it. And that leaves us feeling a little empty. You know, we think to ourselves, well, I really like you, Plato, in terms of your great strong affirmations of an ontological reality, but you're not quite convincing me with your theory of recollection. I mean, I read the Meno dialogue, and that's pretty impressive, but really still I'm not so sure that that proves to me that that ideal world is actually there. And so while he's ontologically strong, I think he's, what did I write, int? What is that supposed to mean? Epistemologically, it is late in the day. Do you notice that? You know, the sort of the whatever the blood sugar is that's supposed to make your brain work is pretty much gone. So Mr. Mean, Dykstra.
I need just remedial help here. I'm sorry. What is ontology versus epistemology? Is that a dumb question?
That is a dumb question. That's really, you know, where have you been? How many times in class have you wanted to say that to a student? That is the dumbest question. Oh, who can help out? Who can? Okay, I want to. Mrs. Culberson can answer that question because she's been paying attention. So please give us the answer.
Ontology is what is real, right?
Right.
The study or the science or study of being, what is real?
Being. Mm-hmm.
Okay. As epistemology is, how do I know what is real? Are you taking notes?
You know.
For Mr. Gordon nod, so I
that's right. All right. Well, it's not such a dumb question after all, but we did chat about it right early on. But ontology is that branch of philosophy that concerns the question of what is actually real, what is real. And you remember Parmenides said, the answer is whatever is. You know, that's what's real. Heraclitus, on the other hand, kind of gives us the answer, really nothing is real. The only thing real is that there's nothing real. The only thing you depend on is there's nothing you depend on. You know, so that was really the context for that whole conversation. And so epistemology concerns the matter of how do we know? And how do we know that what we know is actually, you know, in any way corresponding to what we think is real? So it's the study of knowledge and the theory of knowledge. Fair enough? Okay, so that's it. So anyway, we say, okay, in terms of Plato's ontology, even as Christians, we like him. He's going in the right direction. He says there's a true transcendent order that is fixed, eternal, permanent, dependable, reliable. But he leaves us a little bit flat at the point of how we know it. So far, so good. Then we come to Aristotle. And interestingly enough, of course, Aristotle gives us just the flip side of this. So Plato's giving us the classical answer from the point of rationalism. Aristotle's giving the classic answer from the point of empiricism, and he comes out on just the opposite side. We ask on the question of epistemology, the question, how do we know? How do we have certainty? And he looks really good. He looks a lot better than Plato. Because Aristotle gives us science. And science has huge credibility. I mean, more today, even in the ancient world. But, you know, you show a guy with a white science, one of those coats, I don't know why they wear them, but they have the little pins in their pocket and they have little, and you think, he's a scientist, he knows everything. You know, you have this, I mean, isn't there in our culture, scientists are kind of the high priests. You know, they know the answers. Science has, science puts people on the moon. Science does things. And so all through history, we've had a huge amount of confidence in the scientific epistemology. Now, even more today, I'm just saying even in the ancient world, that carried some freight, but even more these days. So Aristotle, how does he give us confidence? Well, he takes us out and shows us stuff. He says, you know, we're not going to speculate, we're not going to try to recall a perfect, eternal, ideal, transcendent, essential squirrel. We're going to go look at squirrels, you see. And Mr. Dijkstra says, let's go out and take a peek at squirrels. And so we look at squirrels, and we see squirrels after squirrels, and we notice they all have bushy tails. And after a while, we think we can extrapolate from the data with a high degree of confidence, squirrels have bushy tails. And it seems to be more certain than engaging in this kind of contemplative mysticism that Plato wants to give to us. Let's just imagine. Let's just remember. We go. But Mr. Dijkstra gives us squirrels. So we feel. So epistemologically, do you see, he gives us something in which we can have some confidence. He's strong. But where is Aristotle's great vulnerability?
Ontology.
Thank you. Excellent, you see. Because ontology raises questions that are bigger. It raises kind of like why questions. It raises questions about values. It raises questions about ought. In a sense, Aristotle can tell us what is, but where does he leave us when it's the question of what ought to be? And all he can do is try to move somehow or other from isness to oughtness. For Plato, this is not a problem. The ought of life is rooted in the fact that there is true transcendent value. There is good, there is bad. We didn't create it. We don't vote it in. We don't vote it out. It is there whether we like it or not. It is something binding on us, and we are bound to recognize it, acknowledge it. The problem he has is how do we know for sure that it's out there? Well, Aristotle gives us a lot of confidence about what he's telling us, but then when he tries to take us to this level of ought, that's when he looks a little flat. Because for him, there really isn't this transcendent order. Even his God is not exactly a great source of the oughtness of life. I was trying to illustrate this to the students the other day and approached it this way. Let's say that it's 40 years down the road, and Mr. Gore is now 100 years old. Still in pretty good health for a 100-year-old, but, you know, getting up there. And let's say that one of you students, I don't mean you, I mean one of the seniors who are, you know, about 18 years old now, 40 years from now, how old will they be? 58, is that about right? So there you are. And let's say you're downtown and you're at an intersection and you see that venerable Mr. Gore standing there on the street corner. And you think to yourself, that's right. Well, nothing's changed. And so you're sitting there in your nice car. Here you are. You're a successful person. You graduated from the Oaks. You got a great education. You make lots of money. You're driving your nice car. And there you are. And here's poor Mr. Gore, who's, of course, by this time just, you know, just barely clinging to life. And so you think to yourself, oh, look at that. That's Mr. Gore. I took philosophy from him. I remember that guy. And you have a choice to make. So I'm painting now what is supposed to be an ethical dilemma. And the dilemma is this, you know, should I get out of my car and go over and greet Mr. Gore, say it's nice to see you, help him cross the street because now he needs that, or because he gave me a C in philosophy, should I wait for him to step out in front of my car and then just mow him down? Grease spot time. I've been waiting for this for years, finally. What's that? Very funny. Very funny.
And for good reason.
Well, let me tell you. You know, you got to think about these things. So anyway, now we have to come to these two great theorists and ask them the question, how do we resolve the ethical dilemma? The dilemma is, do we help Mr. Gore cross the street or do we run over him? These are the choices. You know, I mean, sometimes in ethical decisions, it's a more subtle distinction. But for purposes of our present conversation, we're going to let you have no other possibilities. You have to do one or the other. Which one will you do? Now, interestingly, both Plato and Aristotle will probably agree, you know, barring any other extraneous information, that what? What do you think they would both agree you should do under those circumstances?
Well, I don't think you should run him over.
Okay, all right. So they concur, you know. But the reason they agree is very different. In other words, the conclusion they reach is the same, but the way they got there is rather different. How does Plato reach the conclusion that you should assist Mr. Gore in crossing the street rather than running over? How does Plato answer the question? Mr. Dower Sr., what do you suppose? You're a Platonic philosopher, and the question is put to you. What would you say is the correct answer? I mean, what would you say is the explanation, the reason that we should help Mr. Gore cross the street?
Because Mr. Gore is the ideal.
Yeah, well, sounds good.
And here is his representation.
That's a little over the top. Not quite that far. You know, it doesn't really have that much to do with Mr. Gore, but you're on the right track. What's the reason? Why would Plato say you should help Mr. Gore?
Well, because we know it's right.
It's right, and why is it right?
Because we know that it's right. Well,
all right, well, that's how we know it. But the fundamental answer, why should I do it, is because, as you said, it's right. It corresponds to a reality in this universe of what is the good. And the good says that you should, as a general rule, help little old tottering people across the street rather than run over them. That is a fundamental ethical rule, and I didn't put it there by my preference, my taste, my vote, my decision, anything. It's already there. It was there before I came on the scene. It'll be there long after I'm gone. It is a fixed, eternal principle of the good. See? Yes, sir?
Would he say that there is an ideal man on an ideal street with the ideal help across the street?
I don't know that he would say that, but in principle, it is kind of what he is saying. He's saying that this decision to help is reflective of some great eternal principle. But I don't think he would. I mean, you could push Plato and almost get him there, but I don't think he'd actually say that. But he would say there is this idea of the good. Yeah.
But your ontology and your ethics are both based upon your epistemology.
Yeah.
And since your epistemology is weak, you really don't know the good.
That's right. Well, that's the Achilles heel. Plato would say, you say to Plato, well, I'm not so sure we should help him across. I mean, we should mow him down. And Plato would say, well, that's just because you're not an enlightened person. You need to have a philosopher king who shows you what is good. You know, it becomes rather elitist. But that's the point. You see that. How do I know that good? Well, I'm just supposed to have a sense of it. I just have an idea. And you know as well as I do that there's some people who would question that idea, especially these days. But he believes he's given us a good, strong ontology, a good, strong basis for our ethics. We come along, we say, okay, Aristotle, you agree now that we should help this man rather than run over him. What is your reason? Aristotle reasons quite differently. He reaches the same conclusion, but he gets there down a different path. What is the path Aristotle takes to get to that conclusion? How does he do it? How do you suppose? Speculate a little bit. Go ahead. Mr. Fugit?
Well, he views that it is not good for mankind to kill one another. He views that, he empirically deduces that, and therefore, by knowing that empirically, he therefore justifies...
But how does he know it empirically? How does he know what the good is empirically? See, how does he know that? That, you're kind of pushing him back toward Plato here. The good, you've already had to presuppose the idea of the good, you know, to make that. How does he know what is the good? That's right.
Okay. This is better than that.
Actually, it's not even that deep. I'm simplifying Aristotle. He would object to what I'm saying, but in principle, this is the difference. He opts for a kind of statistical morality. He notices. He goes out there and observes human behavior. And he notices that so far, 100 times out of 100, when people drive up to the intersection and they have those two choices, they get out and help the old guy rather than running over him. And so he makes a note, he tallies it up, he says, okay, on the basis of scientific, empirical research, I've reached the conclusion based on behavior that because this is what people do, it is what people ought to do. And he makes the leap from the is to the ought, really, as an act of faith. Right? And you say to Aristotle, well, how do I know that just because people do stuff that makes it right? And you see, he doesn't have a good answer for that. You see the point. Plato is ontologically strong, epistemologically weak. Aristotle is epistemologically strong, but ontologically weak. He doesn't leave us with a good, strong foundation outside of just observation of what to do. And you realize how sticky that becomes. The fact that I know how to build a bomb doesn't mean necessarily I ought to build a bomb. The scientist is really good at telling me how to build the bomb. Now, maybe not so good at telling me whether I should build the bomb. You see, that's the classic problem of the scientist. He can create the widget, but should he have created the widget? Let alone, what's the right thing to do with it? Do you feel it? That's the classic problem of the scientist. The philosopher gives us good, penetrating ethical thoughts about things, but no good reason why. He gives us a decent reason why, but finally doesn't, you know, give us a good foundation for that good being there in the first place. You see that kind of... Notice that my dilemma that I gave you about helping me cross the street is one thing. How about if it's a closer call? How about if it's, let's say, a society has a certain view of the, let's say, the value of an unborn life. And let's say we're in a particular society where a bare 51% believe that an unborn life should be protected. But 49% believe that generally it is expendable. Okay? Close call, right? And so let's say that we're in a society where a bare majority of people believe that an unborn life has dignity and worth and needs to be protected. Well, if you're Plato, you don't give a rip what the division of the population is. What's right is right. And if a majority votes against it, they're just wrong. You know. But if you're Aristotle, where do you left? You know, you're left with this kind of thing, well, this is right, I guess, isn't it? So then Madison Avenue goes out, launches a huge ad campaign, nationwide advertisements, billboards, every device of psychic manipulation that is available to the very talented wizards of advertising that you find, in a society like ours, and they just do a blitz for 1 month. And they are able to reach the 2% of the population who are the most unthinking, unprincipled, weak-minded, just sort of, you know, superficial people, and get them to change their minds. And they drift over here. So that now this has become the bare majority. For Aristotle, what's happened? That's right. What's right and wrong has just changed. You see, you feel the problem. There's the problem. I think you all have a pretty good sense of that. All right. The Christian faith comes along. And aside from the fact that it has this wonderful theology of Christ, God becoming man, dying an atoning death, and so on, it brings with it a philosophy. This is not, you know, it's not the first thing that hits you as you start reading the New Testament. But it, in fact, provides an ontology and an epistemology, doesn't it? So boy, is it warm in here? Are you warm? I'm really getting warm. Can I do this? Is this? Okay, well, that may be all we can. See ya. Having a hot flash, I don't know. Tell ya. So, the Christian faith comes on the scene, and certainly the whole, you know, Jewish background to it as well. What is the ontological foundation for the good, the true, the beautiful, from a Christian or from a biblical point of view? What is it? Sure. That's okay. That's right. Was that what you were going to say? Yes. Yeah, God and self-disclosure. Okay, now, hold on. So as you start about self-disclosure, that's a different topic. You see? So just hang on to that. But yeah, we would say with Plato, there is a transcendent order. It is fixed, it is eternal, it is unchanging. We didn't vote it in, and we can't fire it. This thing that we call God is infinitely superior to us. And you see, really, the Christian faith out Plato's Plato. Plato gave us a transcendent order, but nothing like this. Nothing like the infinite personal God that, as Schaeffer liked to call him, you know, this God who is all-powerful, eternal, and in every possible way we could describe the greatest single core reality of all of things. You know, so we have a good, powerful, strong, robust ontology as Christian people. How about our epistemology? What is our epistemology? Mr. Young, now.
That's self-disclosure.
Okay. And we call that, go ahead, that word is? Revelation. Where Plato gives us recollection, the Christian faith gives us revelation. How much better is revelation than recollection? And in what, how does the New Testament describe the revelation that comes to us? Just what are some of the words that kind of pop into your mind when you think about the way in which the New Testament conveys the notion of revelation? Did you have any words that just kind of...
Incarnation.
Incarnation. What does that mean?
God become man.
Yeah. So God, the ontological reality of all the universe, steps across the divide and is living here among us as a concrete expression of space, time, reality here among us. Right? That's a pretty big deal. You know, how many religions say anything like that? Virtually always the religions leave us in a kind of Platonic quest, a speculative venture into outer space to find God hiding out there. And you've got to be very disciplined, and you have to kind of rise to these levels of mystical something or other, and then you, there's God, and what can you say about it? You know, you're sort of speechless. It's ineffable. The Christian faith says, no, we don't go chasing God out there, finding behind a moon of Saturn or something. You know, God comes down here, and he comes down as an empirical, verifiable reality. So you have statements like, listen to this. This is from 1 John 1:1. That which was from the beginning, which, what? Do you know that verse? Which we have seen, have heard, have looked upon, and our hands have handled. How satisfied is a scientist, Mr. Dykstra, with that which you can see, which you can hear, which you can closely examine, and which you can handle?
We like
that. You see how the New Testament doesn't leave us in la-la land. It says, no, God stepped across the divide and gave to the hardcore empiricist everything that person could want. And this has been the great, sort of like this huge, cataclysmic development in the history of the human race, that here you have a system of thought that gives you an eternal, transcendent order of truth and beauty and goodness that actually walked among us, that was actually here. You know, we don't simply have an enlightened spirit. We don't have a Buddha, a Muhammad, a man who has great mystic insight, and we just are supposed to trust him. We don't have that. We also don't have a distant God who is inaccessible beyond our reach, but we're just supposed to kind of believe him's there by an intuition. We have the best of both. We have everything that this transcendent God can be, who actually came down and lived among us and spoke with authority and proved himself to be what he claimed to be and left us with no rational doubt about the reality, both of this historical individual and the God that indeed he was among us. You see, that's a powerful thing. You know. And so in a sense, what you say is the Christian faith comes along as the great synthesis, without even trying, you know, because it's epistemologically strong, based on revelation, God's word. Jesus is called the Logos, the Word. That's a revelatory idea, you know. And at the same time, it's ontologically strong. We don't have one of those nitwit deities of the Greeks that are always, you know, murdering and committing adultery and doing. We don't have that. We have the God of the universe who lived here among us. And that's powerful stuff. That has really, that's made the Christian faith throughout history the force to be reckoned with. You know, when you think about, I see your hand, when you think about the great atheist philosophers of history, who are they trying to take down? They're never trying to take down Hinduism. They're not bothering with Buddhism. They don't even mess around much with Islam. The big boogeyman in their atheistic world is Christianity. That's the one that they have so much trouble with, because it brings with so, it has so much horsepower. You know. Go ahead.
Is your hot flash over?
It really isn't. I'm really. Are you getting cold? I'm still really warm. Well, I got pants on. I mean, sorry. It is warm in here, isn't it? I'm really warm.
Maybe we should take a poll.
Yeah, maybe. Look at poor Mr. Ingard. He's shivering here. Look at this man. All right. Common question, thoughts about that. That's part one. I want to cover a little bit more, but this is kind of the biggie here. Yes.
This actually goes back a little further. With Aristotle, is it fair to call him a pragmatist?
Yeah, more than Plato. Yeah. Pragmatism as a philosophy, I wouldn't want to pin that on him. You've certainly got, you know, you have more. You have John Stuart Mill's. You've got Jeremy Bentham. You've got William James, you've got some true pragmatists in history who would be more, they would really build their whole philosophy around a kind of philosophical pragmatism. Aristotle has a lot more going on than that. And I've really overstated Aristotle here. But I think in principle the idea is true. There is a great divide between the rationalist and the empiricist, and in some ways Aristotle does have this problem. Even his Ethics is built really on a kind of observational analysis. He notices that people feel happy when they eat chocolate chip cookies. Remember that? He notices that when people win at chess, they are happier than if they lose. He observes that if people give, it is more blessed for them. So he's really being a scientist all the way through. But he grants that there's something else going on here. But he doesn't try to go beyond simply the conclusions he can reach by virtue of just observation. Was there, yeah?
Yeah, it's funny that the scientist should be satisfied with what he sees and hears, and can examine closely, and he can feel. But then he, after seeing and hearing and examining closely and feeling, he says, "Can you do that again?"
That's right.
He makes it a test.
Yeah, yeah.
it's got to be repeatable now.
Yeah, yeah, and they did that to Jesus. You know, here's Jesus. There's a great story. I think it's in Luke 11. Jesus casts a demon out of a guy, you know, and the first thing they say is, well, show us a sign from heaven. What was wrong with that? I thought that was pretty good, actually. You know, a guy that's been, you know, just tormented by demons for years, and he's immediately liberated by just a word from Christ. And, well, but do something really good for us, would you? You know, what have you done for us lately, kind of thing. And that's really, really true. Which says, you know, bottom line, the problem is not so much, you know, lack of evidence, but it goes much deeper. It's a won't believe rather than, you know. All right, fair enough. I'm going to take about just a few more minutes. What I'd like to do is just touch on the first two or three centuries of Christian history. There really is not, you know, there's no great philosophers that come along now until Augustine. Probably the closest thing to it would be a Plotinus. And next time we're going to look at the two pagan philosophers that pop up in the third century who are really trying to respond. They're the first guys who show up who try to take down Christianity. They come on as admitted pagans who want to attack the Christian faith. And one of them is a guy named Mani, who gives us Manichaeism, and the other is Plotinus, who gives us Neoplatonism. And I want to look at them briefly as a run-up to Augustine, who's the next great giant thinker, you know, and we'll spend a little time on Augustine. But just to kind of fill in what's going on philosophically, you know, during this two or three centuries, what I'd like to do is talk about this from the point of view of apologetics, first of all, and then next time when we come back, we'll look at what's going on in terms of heresies. Heresies teach you an awful lot about the Christian faith and kind of the currents of the day, so we'll do that. All right, so you may know this, but in the early going for the Christian faith, second century, it was accused, there were some specious claims that were made about what Christians believe. Have you ever come across this? I know Mr. Fugit has, and maybe some of you have. What were some of the things Christians were accused of in the second century especially? We were cannibals. Not good. So Christians are accused of cannibalism. What else are we accused of?
Thieves. They meet early in the morning.
Thieves. Okay. Good. How do you spell that? Good grief. T-H-I? I-E.
B-E-S.
B-E-S. I can't scribble. Miss Muse is here. What else were we accused of? Mr. Fugit?
We were accused of being atheists.
Atheists. What else were we accused of?
Incest.
There's one other kind of big one we were accused of. Well, we were accused of absurdity. Is that we were actually accused of philosophical absurdity? But there's something else. There was a political charge. We were accused of treason. Those are the main ones. There were others that were mentioned, but these would probably be the ones that are most famous. And so, what you have, the birth of apologetics, which is Christian philosophy. Apologetics is philosophy. So when we talk about philosophy, and at least from the Christian point of view, we have to incorporate a little bit of apologetics in the discussion as well. What it calls forth from the church early on, second century, is what's called the first little foray into defensive apologetics, in which we're being defended from charges. The Christian apologetics became offensive soon enough. We quit just defending ourselves and started delivering some punches of our own. But the first foray into sort of philosophical Christianity, apologetics, was this defensive apologetics. And who's the name? Oh, I gave it to you, so forget it. Justin Martyr, there it is. Anybody know anything about Justin Martyr? Who is he? Anybody know? No? Ever heard the name? Justin Martyr? You've heard of him? Sure. Yeah. He's not the first name that would pop up. You've got Ignatius of Antioch. You've got Polycarp. You've got Clement of Rome. There's some other names. But the first guy that comes along who would conceive of himself as a philosopher. In fact, his own testimony of his life is he was a philosopher before he was a Christian. And philosophers would travel around. They'd wear kind of the philosophical garments, you know, the kind of robes. It had a little badge on it, philosopher sort of thing. And they would try to, you know, get followers. And people would pay them money to hear them talk. It's a great idea. I like it. And so Justin Martyr was a philosopher. And then he became a Christian. He says he was converted largely through the persuasive impact of fulfilled prophecy. That seeing the life of Christ against the backdrop of Hebrew prophetic material persuaded him. You know, so he comes across. And so, but he continues to be a philosopher. So he holds himself out as a philosopher throughout his career. And he travels around, he talks to people, but now he's talking kind of evangelistically. But he also writes and he responds to these charges. And this gets him a little bit into philosophical ideas. His most famous work along these lines is entitled Apologia. Which of course means apology or defense. From apa, logic, from reason. So an apology is that which is given from reason to defend. It's the word that's used in the New Testament. Sanctify the Lord God in your heart and be ready always to give a defense of the hope that lies within you, an apology for it, you know. So that's what he does. He writes this apology to a guy named the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius. Around the year 150. And he responds to these charges. And of course he gives the responses you would anticipate. You know, we are not cannibals. When we eat flesh and drink blood, this is sacramental. You know, we're not actually having, you know, our good buddy for dinner there kind of thing. He responds to the charge of atheism by affirming that we do believe in God, but this happens to be a God that is not, you know, reducible to images and so on, such as the Roman pantheon. My favorite story about this charge of atheism concerns a guy named Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna. But you know the story of the martyrdom of Polycarp? You ever read that? It's great stuff. Do you? Remember the part about atheism that plays into the story?
It's been a while since I've heard it.
Here's Polycarp. He's 86 years old, Polycarp. He's just been arrested. He's the bishop of Smyrna. He's a highly respected man. But under Antoninus Pius, who was a pretty good emperor, they've launched once again a somewhat widespread persecution, and they're hauling him in. And so Polycarp, who is fairly well respected, nevertheless is brought into the arena there in Smyrna. And the proconsul is feeling bad at the prospect of executing an 86-year-old man. And so he has this great conversation with him. Polycarp, you're an old man. You've got grandkids, you know. How can I let you off easy? Look, tell you what. Why don't you just, and he gives him these options, why don't you just swear by the fortune of Caesar and I'll let you go. That's all. Polycarp says, no, sorry. Just say, Kaiser Kurios. Polycarp says, sorry, Jesus, ho Kurios. Jesus is the Lord. Look, Polycarp, come on, man. What can we work out here? Let's make a deal. I don't want to have to burn you at the stake. And Polycarp gives this great speech. He says, look, maybe you didn't notice this, but I'm a Christian. Now, if you want to hear the claims of the Christian faith, then appoint a time and place, I'll be happy to come and present it to you, you know, kind of deal. And so the thing goes on. But one of the options that the proconsul gives him is he says, look, Polycarp, if you'll just say, away with the atheists, I'll let you go. So Polycarp goes, I can do that. So Polycarp looks at the stands. He says, away with the atheists. The proconsul goes, that's not what I meant. Anyway, Polycarp does wind up being burnt at the stake. It's a great story of an early martyr. And anyway, but they were accused of atheism, accused of incest. Why would Christians be accused of incest? Brothers and sisters meeting in these little secret meetings and so on. Treason, of course, because they would not acknowledge the Caesar as an object of worship. You know, and so that was viewed as insurrection, so on. So anyway, Justin Martyr is famous for that. He's also famous for being the first guy outside the New Testament to make prominent use of the word logos. And so he really gets mileage out of that. When he's in writing and when he's in conversation then with the Greek world of his day, although it's the Roman world, it's still the Greek influence, he makes a whole lot out of that. This logos that you've been looking for, this logos who was mentioned by Heraclitus and was, you know, part of the Stoic religion, and this logos that is so important down through the years, here he is. This is what you've been groping for, you know. So he makes that kind of presentation, and other things. Anyway, just so you know his name, we would call him probably the first Christian philosopher. He's not a great thinker. He's smarter than the average bear, you know. I mean, he's a smart guy, but he doesn't rise to levels of true brilliance. But he's a important guy, and he's sort of the first guy on the scene. Travis Walker, his senior year, translated from Greek one of the writings of Justin Martyr, and it was a pretty good piece of work. He did a good job on it, and so anyway. The next fellow that shows up is named Irenaeus. Irenaeus. His name is based on the Greek word Irene, or actually Irene, which means, you should know, Mr. Palpin, do you know that word? What is Irenic? Irenic. Peace. Yeah. Peace. It was an Irenic scene. Peaceful. Irenaeus. The name means peace. He was an apologist, but he's the first offensive apologist. And he writes a great work called Against Heresies. He was like this mole. He joined a Gnostic cult and sat at the feet of one of the best-known Gnostics of his day and mastered the material. And then later he writes this in voluminous treatise, and probably you know, a good 80% of what we know about ancient Gnosticism comes from Irenaeus. We would be greatly impoverished if we didn't have his writing. And he just lambasts them, shows the absurdity of it. He goes into incredible detail. And so he's a fun guy to read. Another interesting thing about Irenaeus, though, is Irenaeus was acquainted with Polycarp and reminisces about his acquaintance with Polycarp in his writings. Polycarp had been a student in Ephesus of John the Apostle, who, of course, had been a student of Jesus of Nazareth. And so you'll read these, it's almost kind of a little bit eerie, you know. You read Irenaeus, and you realize you're still in a chain of people who knew the guy, who knew the guy, who knew the guy, who knew Jesus. You know? And you're still that close. Even a couple of hundred years out, you still have that chain of personal recollection. So Irenaeus will sometimes kind of digress in his writings and do these little musings about his recollection. But anyway, he's most famous for that. Tertullian. Anybody know what's the single greatest contribution that Tertullian made to the history of the church? He gave us one big word. The biggest word he gave us, it's used to this day.
Trinity.
Trinity is correct.
It's correct?
That's right. That's very good. Give me five. Excellent, yeah. All right. Tertullian was a Roman lawyer, and he worked out a conception of Trinity, which eventually was viewed as not quite right. But he gave us the word triunity, and he certainly kind of was the first one to try to conceptualize this very sticky problem of how we affirm on the one hand we have one God, and yet we clearly distinguish among three different persona. In some sense or other, there's a threeness and a oneness, and how do we do that exactly? And Tertullian gave us this, his answer, which was based kind of on Roman law. And he said it was sort of like, you know, in the Roman world as well as in our world, you can form a corporation. We can have, you know, Carolyn Garfield. We could also have Carolyn Garfield Inc., right? We could. She could incorporate herself. And if you incorporate, so here we have Carolyn Garfield, and she creates a new person, Carolyn Garfield Inc. And that person can own, can buy, can sell, can be sued, can act like it as if it were a real person in many, many different ways. It's a fiction, and yet it's treated as a legal reality. You know, and people do that, you know, for a variety of reasons. And that's kind of what he posits. He says, you know, in a sense, here's God, and he's created now these three, as it were, alter egos. The church didn't ultimately go for that. Felt that it didn't quite give enough horsepower to these separate persons. They were still a little bit, it was a little bit of a modalism, you know, in Tertullian, so they kind of didn't accept that. But you can see it was at least an attempt. It was an attempt to kind of give us a conception, which is not all that easy to do, of the Trinity. So he's famous for that. Unfortunately, he also joined the Montanists eventually, which were a heretical bunch, so he's never been called a church father, nor was he ever canonized by Rome. But he was a great guy. He was just kind of sort of, he was a little bit of a whack job, but brilliant, good guy, meant well. The last two here, third century characters, Clement of Alexandria. I have the philosophy kids read a little bit from him. In fact, I have them read back to back a piece from Tertullian and a piece from Clement of Alexandria. Tertullian is the guy who famously said, what has, can you finish that? See, if you nod, then I...
What has Jerusalem to do with Athens?
Exactly, right. What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? He's the great separatist. The Christian faith should not have any kind of league with pagan philosophy at all. He hates Greek philosophy. He also famously said, I believe because it is, anybody finish that little phrase?
Absurd.
You know. Kind of stands for the great Phidiast of ancient history, although that's a little... Yeah, the Montanus, Montanus, Montanus. Clement, on the other hand, is just the opposite. Clement says that Greek philosophy is the handmaid of theology. Greek philosophy will lead us to the truth. We should study Plato because, in fact, there's wonderful insights there that actually show us Christ. And so these two guys have a kind of cold war going on as to how much can we make use of, you know, philosophical speculation in the pagan world. And then finally, Origen. And I'll just... Origen, again, is in Alexandria. He's heavily influenced by the Greeks. He's a little bit of a mystic, a little bit of a Gnostic, certainly a heretic, but a great guy. And he has a wonderful, all kinds of influence. I'll just give you one by way of illustration. He takes the Greek view of humanity that we are tripartite beings. We're body, soul, and spirit. And the Greeks, of course, would place a value judgment on these. Originally, Plato said body and soul. But later Greek thinkers, trying to work out the sort of dualism that created, imagined a third level that's sort of neutral, hanging in the middle. So it became body, soul, and spirit. Body represents that part of us that has a penchant toward evil. It's tainted, as Plato would say. It's the seat of our wickedness. It's located down here in the body. The spirit is substantially virtuous. So the body is evil, the spirit is virtuous, and the soul is hanging there in the middle trying to decide which way to go. Sort of the neutral level. See? And then he brought that idea to everything in life. He brought it, for example, to the Bible and said, when you read the Bible, it has three meanings. It has the literal meaning, the moral meaning, and the eternal meaning. You follow that?
No, okay. So say this, or
Origen says this. Okay. This is Origen's Greek influence on reading the Bible. So you run into the word Jerusalem. Jerusalem has a literal meaning, a city in Palestine. If you take a Greek view of humanity, how important is that meaning? Remember, the body is tainted. That's right. Really doesn't care about the meaning of the word Jerusalem associated with a city in Palestine, because that's just the bodily meaning. That's the this-worldly meaning that really the Greeks figure is not that important. Then Jerusalem also has a moral meaning. Maybe that stands for, in broad terms, the moral decisions we make or something like that. But then, of course, maybe Jerusalem has a spiritual or ultimate or eternal meaning. Maybe in that sense it represents heaven. I'm not saying that's what he taught, but that's the idea. You go through the Bible, and every text in the Bible has three meanings, the least of which, the least important of which, is its actual plain sense meaning. You see what happens to Bible reading? You start treating the Bible like a kind of mystical book with all sorts of hidden meanings. And the least important part of it is this concrete meaning associated, because that's a Greek influence. That grew later into what was called the quadriga, the fourfold method of interpretation. And that's how come Rome could eventually say to the ordinary mortals in the world, don't even try reading that book. It is so hard, it's so complicated, so many deep meanings, you'll never figure it out. Just trust us. And really that was, by the Middle Ages you have that kind of an expansion of that. Does that make sense? I'm throwing that at you kind of fast, but that's the idea. Please.
So is the four part, is that Aquinas?
Aquinas, it's earlier than Aquinas. Aquinas never really argues with it, but on the other hand, when you read him, he's not the guy that he's not putting a whole lot of weight on that. But he never tackles it. Luther's the first guy to really attack the quadriga. Aquinas is sort of ambivalent about it. Yeah.
We're still here, really.
Yeah.
We're still coming out of that.
Yeah.
The idea of scripture as a literal story is almost, you feel a little bit heretical saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been interesting about your Proverbs or Psalms with the kids or, tying in connections. This actually happened. Somebody wrote this. It's a piece of good advice.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That influence is still very much with. I only mention this just to give you a kind of a taste of how things were going, at this point. So, you've been very patient in a room that's 300 degrees. Comments, questions, feedback, debate, clarification.
I know this opportunity. You